Ready to turn your house into the home you've always dreamed of without the headaches or huge bills? You're tuned to Around the House, the nation's number one home improvement radio show and podcast, with expert advice that's helped millions tackle everything from remodels to repairs. Hosts Eric G. and John Dudley have got you covered with the best advice and information about your home. Now, let's get this hour started.
Welcome to the Around the House Show, your trusted source for everything about your home. Thanks for joining me today. We've got a fun one ahead. We're talking here with Robert Thomas from the Pacific Legal Foundation. These are the guys that help you protect your property rights and everything around your home like that. Welcome to Around the House, brother.
Thank you very much, Eric. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on today, man. I love what you guys are doing, and I just found you guys recently because it popped across my social media feed, and I went, ooh, more people fighting for the little guy. And so, of course, I reached out and said, I want to have you guys on the show because I love to see that you're helping homeowners and other people out there as well.
Wonderful. That's great news. And we, not long ago, we're the oldest of, first of all, let me go back and say that our primary mission is to represent property owners and others for free in court to test cases where their governments, local and distant, are infringing on their property rights. And so we've been around. I'm glad you found us recently, but I'll say that we've been around for more than half a century, originating down here in California, but now I have lawyers in my property rights group nationwide, from coast to coast, and from time to time beyond coast. So we've had cases in Puerto Rico, Alaska, Hawaii, other places, so across all 50 states and territories. So I'm really glad you found us.
Yeah, thanks, man. And I think it might have been one of the things I've been talking about on the radio from time to time is, for instance, like the California Coastal Commission. They're legendary and kind of making up their own rules and going along the way, especially right now with, I got a buddy that who's an architect who lost his, he was in one of the mobile homes and the view homes in the Pacific Palisades there looking right down the beach. So he's got years ahead before they even think of putting something back on there, if they do. But it's been fascinating following that and everything else that's going down there, or quite frankly, what's not going on down there.
It's interesting to, for us here in California, to see how the Coastal Commission, statewide agency with broad jurisdiction within the coastal zone, a few hundred yards inland from the coast, but the tentacles reach further, which we've known about for years here, for decades, and have considered sort of one of the biggest offenders when it comes to reasonable exercise of our property rights, how because of the Southern California fires and other events lately has really resonated. And now people outside of California are beginning to see, how can that be? Or they're beginning to ask those type of questions that we've asked and challenged for many, many years. One of the very first cases that Pacific Legal Foundation took on and won was against the California Coastal Commission, and a case in 1987 that went up from Southern California, went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court pretty decisively smacked down a Coastal Commission's attempt to stretch its jurisdiction and use its power to force homeowners to give up a property for something as simple as the condition of doing something as straightforward and simple as, oh, I want to tear down a beach bungalow and put up a house. In a case called Nolan against California Commission, California Coastal Commission was our very first big win. And so that agency has been on our radar since at least 1987. And it is very interesting to us that the excesses of that agency are now being recognized outside of the Golden State.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. And you're right. I've been following that Coastal Commission for a number of years, just kind of watching stuff because in my business and remodeling and design, you kind of watch that stuff and see how it goes. And every time, I mean, even the latest stuff that you guys have, the new case that you guys have been working on, I was kind of reading through that real quick. And I think they're asking for the homeowner to to be able to tear their house down at a moment's notice and basically give their rights away as homeowners just to get approval or a potential approval for a new house.
Exactly. And again, it's one of those things that until you see it almost in writing, that it's kind of hard to believe that that would come out of our government that's supposed to be there, chosen by us, working for us. It's in this 250th birthday of the United States, we have to go back and remember that if we ever wondered what the whole purpose of government was, well, 250 years ago, they actually wrote it down in a document and said the whole purpose of government is to protect people's life, liberty, and property and their pursuit of happiness. So government's supposed to be there to help us, but it does seem a lot these days that government's there designed, its purpose is to do something else, and it isn't protect us. Exactly. In the case you mentioned, one of the conditions of, okay, we'll give you permission to do X, Y, and Z, but in return for that, you have to agree to bind yourself and future owners to tear down your house. Excuse me, tear out the improvements and tear down your house if the commission in the future thinks you should. And that just seems insane until you read it in writing and there it is, plain as day.
Yeah.
And so we're taking that on almost right after we closed the books on one of our biggest wins in decades against the Coastal Commission. In, of all places, the California Supreme Court. We did not have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court on our latest
win. Wow.
But just last month, beat the California Supreme, or in the California Supreme Court, ruled for us unanimously. A small, modest little home builder in Central California had received the permission from the county. He was out. He wasn't inside any city. So he looked for permissions like you do in unincorporated areas. Looked for approvals from the county, and the county, which had a long history with this guy, and he had made some very modest home development, single family residences, and had actually followed through and done everything the right way. So the county was pretty familiar with this guy and said, yeah, you can continue on that project and build two more homes. Well, the Coastal Commission got wind of it. And then this is one of those things that, until you see it in writing, it kind of makes no sense. Under California law, any two coastal commissioners can appeal another government agency's approval of a permit in the coastal zone to themselves. It's like judge, jury, and executioner, right? We tend to think, no, the judge should not be the prosecutor. But under the California system, two coastal commissioners can object and say, we appeal the local government's approvals to the very commission that we sit on. And that's what happened here. And that there was a fight. And it was essentially a fight where the two wolves are deciding over which of them gets to eat the lamb, in a sense. The county saying, no, we have jurisdiction to decide this issue and what we say goes. The commission saying, no, we're the ultimate deciders of what goes on in the coastal zone. And after a very long process, our client was vindicated. The property owner, the home builder, the California Supreme Court unanimously said that, oh no, Coastal Commission, butt out, you're exceeding your jurisdiction, you're not supposed to be doing that type of thing. Local county, you have the authority to decide these things. You decided that he should be allowed to build, and get out of the way. And it ordered the California Coastal Commission to dismiss its own appeal and let these permits go into effect. So we think that one, pretty significant win after a long period where California courts were very much in rule in favor of the Coastal Commission. So that gives us some, lets us take heart that this latest case, the courts will see it in much the same way.
Make sure and follow us on social media and our YouTube channels. To find all the links, head to AroundTheHouseOnline.com. We will be right back talking about your property rights from Robert Thomas from the Pacific Legal Foundation.
We'll be right back. What's up? This is Sticks It In Ya.
And Satchel from Steel Panther. And you are listening to
Around the House with Eric G.
Yeah.
We love Eric G, and you should too.
Welcome back to Around the House. First time catching the show? Find out more about us at AroundTheHouseOnline.com. Now let's get back to talking about your property rights with Robert Thomas from the Pacific Legal Foundation.
Finally, maybe getting, as one columnist put it down here, a reckoning of on its excessive use of its own power.
No kidding. And it's not just California. I mean, I'm in Oregon up here. My little brother and I have a beach house out in Cannon Beach, Oregon out there. And small town politics, man. You got hotel owners that are on the city council that want to shut down as many of the short-term rentals as they can. And they just passed one that I'm furious about where we can't use our fire pit because we are renting short-term rentals a few times a year, and they have outlawed the use of fire pits for anyone that is renting to anyone short-term rental. So my neighbor across the street can use his fire pit perfectly fine. Here's the crazy part. The city-owned RV park next to propane tanks and fireable and fire-prone RVs, and I'm an RV owner, that's perfectly okay to use it there. But if you're renting short-term and you're the homeowner, you can't use a fire pit in the city.
So it doesn't, let me get this straight. It doesn't say, well, someone's renting your property short-term, they can't use the fire pit. But for the other 364 days of the year that you live there and don't rent it to somebody else, because you rent it that one day to somebody else, then you can't use the fire pit.
Correct. 100%.
Okay, well, that makes a whole lot of no sense to me.
Right?
Let's put it that way. And yet the city apparently doesn't have those concerns because in its own, when it rents out space, hey, no problem. Is it correct that they think you're going to be renting to arsonists? I mean, what's the problem?
And on top of that, there's zero history of fire pit structure fires or anything like that. There's nothing in recent history that has come up that I can even search in the news and find. So there's just no story there. But it's the personal interests, it seems, from my opinion at least, of the people that are living in the city that are like, oh no, we're going to control this because they want their hotels to be full. And if they can have a fire pit at their hotels, that's the crazy part.
I did okay in high school history, and I should have stuck with that maybe. But the reason I bring that up is that this all stems back 100 years. Where does this come from? People always ask me that. How come government can come up with all sorts of things that make no sense? And I tell them it started at least with respect to property regulation and the limitations on the uses of property. About 100 years ago, with the advent of something we're very familiar with now, municipal zoning. Before that, governments restricted people's uses for what were harmful uses. You couldn't make use of it. Nobody has the right to make use of their property in a way that is potentially harmful to somebody else or harms the public. And that notion goes back 1,000 years. And then about 100 years ago, local governments started codifying that principle rather than leaving it up to individual homeowners saying, hey, my neighbor is running a garbage dump on their property and they shouldn't be able to do that because it interferes with my use, and allowing the courts to take care of those problems. Municipalities started this thing called zoning, where they said, okay, this part of town is the residential zone. Here's the height limits. Here's the use limits. You can't make a commercial use in a residential zone. And here's the other thing, too, setbacks, right? You can't build. You may own the square footage, but you can't build out to the lot line. You got to set it back for various reasons.
But you could on the north side of the street, but not on the south side of the street. Yeah. And that's where that stuff gets a little crazy.
And yeah, exactly. And you can see it in some instances where, okay, height limitations initially came about because the fire truck ladders couldn't reach up more than 3 stories. Oh, okay. Well, then maybe 3 stories should be our height limit in this town. Oh, that makes some sense. And we didn't know about sprinklers and things like that, or setbacks. Well, things like fire trucks had to go between buildings in order to put out structure fires. And so you wanted some space between buildings and not lot lines, buildings built right next to each other with no gap. But over time, like everything else, sort of mission creep, let's call it, sets in, and the setback itself becomes something that maybe has its own, it's there for its own purposes almost. Well, anyway, this was challenged 100 years ago in a case out of Ohio. And the owner said, hey, these restrictions that you're putting me into these zones kind of arbitrarily really impact my property rights because you haven't shown that I'm doing anything harmful. It's one thing to say I can't do harmful things with my property. That's no infringement on property rights. But to simply say, hey, this is the residential parts of town. And in that case, the village of Euclid, now the city of Euclid, a suburb of Cleveland, said no apartment buildings. And when challenged on that, the city claimed that apartment buildings were harmful and detrimental to the health of the community, which is today, 100 years later, almost a laughable rationale. But in the end, the Supreme Court held that if there's any sort of rational relationship between the restriction and the furtherance of what the court called the public health, safety, welfare, or morals. And it's not hard to see how you can, almost anything is going to qualify on that standard.
Yeah, just depending on stance. It passes
constitutional muster. And we've lived with what we lawyers call the rational basis test. If there's any rational basis for the restrictions, courts take a hand-off approach. And that's the answer I give to people when they say, these things make no sense to us. How can they possibly, these regulations be upheld? Aren't they unconstitutional? And I said, talk to the Supreme Court in 1926.
Yeah.
And see about changing that. And that's one of our missions that we do at PLF is we have cases and are looking for other cases that are challenging that 100-year-old standard. We said what may have made sense 100 years ago doesn't make sense today, and zoning laws and similar types of restrictions, micromanaging your ability to use your property in what seem like obviously reasonable ways, really does infringe on your property rights, and the burden should be on the government, not the homeowner. The burden should be on the government to show that its restrictions on your uses are necessary and will actually result in improvement of the or protection of the public health, safety, and welfare, and not on the owner where it is now under this Euclid case. It should not be on the owner to prove that, well, there I won't what I'm doing won't harm this. It seems that the burdens are distributed all wrong. And so, we're trying to change that.
Yeah. I just saw an interesting one happen locally, and I'm talking blocks away from my house. So the city and the county, a couple cities and counties are going to take this little narrow road that goes between houses and make it a thoroughfare because we are a state of, we have the urban growth boundaries, which says you can build here, you can't build here, that kind of stuff. So this road was going to go through and people were going to lose all their backyards. I mean, it was going to be a fence 3 feet off the back of their house kind of thing as they go through. Because
Around the House, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Around the House. First time catching the show? Find out more about us at aroundthehouseonline.com. Now let's get back to talking about your property rights with Robert Thomas from the Pacific Legal Foundation.
So they're going to have to go through some farmland and along the river a little bit. The homeowner, which I think she, and I could be wrong here, but I think she might have been elderly or she donated her riverfront property to be a wetland reserve. Well, the county rule says that you can't put a road through a wetland reserve. It has to be 100 yards away. That killed that project. And I was like, wow, somebody used the wetland rules back against them to stop a project. And I went, extreme, but wow, interesting.
Right. We've seen that not only from the federal government enforcing, say, the Clean Water Act, and stretching it way beyond what Congress laid out. Congress, back in the People forget it was the Nixon administration that proposed the Clean Water Act. And it was. It was a comprehensive but limited to certain things that the federal government has jurisdiction over. Waters of the United States. And over time, like a lot of other things, that mission creep set in and stretched the notion of waters of the United States to was at one point there was actually something called the migratory bird rule. It was considered that if your pond in your backyard, ducks on their way north and south landed in there, that was considered a water of the United States, therefore subject to Clean Water Act jurisdiction when it was just this pond in your backyard.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court knocked that one down. And then the most recent sort of knockdown of that was, again, one of our cases involving a property in Idaho where the only connection to an actual thing you might deem navigable waters of the United States was subsurface. We're all connected, I guess, but, you know, it was never Congress's intention. So there's those. You also have we have 50 states doing a lot of similar type of restrictions and regulations on those, and then layer on top of that things that are now becoming vogue, these things called wildlife corridors to allow deer and the antelope play across your property. And as they migrate, they need a path and you cannot build in the path. So it's a no build zone on your property that follows deer trails, I guess. And we've been dealing with some of those. Speaking of Cannon Beach, there's also one that's popped up in the news lately about, I understand Cannon Beach is near a beach. Let's put it that way.
Yep.
And because of that sand in the wintertime, because of the tides and the winds and the weather, blows up onto people's property and starts collecting. Well, for the longest time, the Oregon, I think it's the Department of Environment, issued permits to people to clear off the sand. But recently, apparently, there's been a change of heart somewhere in the department, because now these permits that have been issued for years, allowing property owners not only to clear their own land from this sand and their houses to keep them from getting buried in Lawrence of Arabia dunes, I suppose, we're also clearing out the public access ways to and from the beach.
Yeah.
Allow the public to get to the beach, and we're burying those paths in sand. And the owners are like, yeah, we'll clear those out too, because we're Oregonians and we appreciate the ability for the public to get to the beach. Well, for some reason, they shut them down and said, no, you can't do that. So meanwhile, all this publicly owned sand is piling up on the homeowners.
It's even worse than that, because I'm watching it in Cannon Beach, because it's right behind the beach house that we have there. It's we're a block off the beach. Well, 20 years ago, I think, and I could be wrong on the time, it could be 30, but they went in and planted some grasses in front of the beach houses just to kind of keep things going and to keep that sand from moving around as much. Well, the problem was that it's a now considered an invasive plant species. It's not supposed to be there. Well, this sand is now grown up because, as sand does, when it starts to collect, it keeps collecting. And now there's this huge sand dune. So all these homes that had a beautiful view of the beach now look like grasses in sand. They wanted to clean that out and level it back out and restore it the way it's supposed to, except now there's some bird or something that's living in there and they can't go in and do that. And so they won't let them touch it. But no, habitat for something. And now all of a sudden they can't go in and do anything with it. And it's just burying the homes. And so it's even a step beyond that. It's the bird species is going to get hurt if you remove that. But at the same time, every year that gets a foot or two taller. And now these people's homes, which were view homes, aren't really view homes anymore.
Right. They're sitting behind a sand dune.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And it's getting taller every year. And they can't, at some point, it's going to come onto their property as well. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
You and I could talk all day about various situations that seem utterly ridiculous and yet are either not subject to challenge or the courts have upheld government action. And that's like, for us, it presents a target-rich environment in that sense, right? We have no shortage of people calling us up and saying, hey, I hear you work for free. Here's a case I have that might fit the agenda. Including not only just sort of generically property rights, but also specifically about homes that U.S. and Oregon constitutions expressly protecting property, private property and property. But most of the U.S. Constitution and the state constitutions also protect homes specifically in an area that a lot of people don't think about I would like to put on your radar as well, since you're about the home, right? That searches and seizures, right? We tend to think of, oh, hey, come back with a warrant, man, as sort of a thing, a criminal law type of right, a right not to be searched and seized, subject to police and other seizure without some probable cause and a warrant issued by a judge, right? A judge looks at it and say, yeah, there's a good chance you're going to find the murder weapon on this guy's property. And here's a warrant to go find it, to go look for it and find it. But what we're seeing more and more now is what we call administrative or blanket warrants, where in order to get some license to do an occupation, that you have to agree to warrantless, unannounced searches at any time government, zoning, or other inspectors want to come in and search your records. And in a time where more and more of us are working out of our houses, that implicates the right. And what's nice about the U.S. Constitution in particular, it says not only is your property protected, your person's homes, houses, and effects are protected against unreasonable searches and seizures. Yes. But we see this more and more. And so you have physical therapists who work out of their home saying in return for a license, you've got to be available for inspection unannounced anytime, or you mentioned short-term rental operators. We see that as well, saying as a condition of getting this license from the government to operate your business, you got to open your records, your houses, we're going to be able to come in and look around, see if there's any violations of law. And so I wanted to put that on your radar as well, because that we've got a textual basis in the Constitution says your home, your house is protected.
Yep.
So
and that's clearly written. There's no doubt about that.
No, there is. There, at least in my mind, there isn't.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's black and white. That's how I see that one. Right. And another case that
Not so much. So that's what our job is as Pacific Legal Foundation.
I'm watching a court case play out because I owned a home by this lake, and here in Oregon, we have Lake Oswego, which is south of Portland. And that one's been going on for a number of years because it's a private lake. When I purchased my house, I had a portion of the lake that I owned. It's on my deed of my home. So, and it added value to it because I had beach rights. I had boat rights. I had all these things I could do. This has been for over 50 years, probably close to 100 years. This has been a private lake. It was a tiny lake that they were using for a big iron mill before, and people started putting their cabins around it. And when they did that and they incorporated the city, so many houses around owned part of that lake because it was done over private property, and that's how they maintained the lake and all the other stuff. Well, now the state is saying that, well, shoot, that's not a private lake. All our waterways are navigable and public, including your private lake that they own, but they're not paying anyone for taking away their, I mean, that added $40,000 to the price of my home. They take that away, I'm like, where's my compensation for that?
There you go, right? I mean, there is a way if they want to turn your lake into a state park, pretty likely there's not a whole lot you can do about it if they do it the right way, which is use the eminent domain power, take it for public use, and then compensate you at the fair market value for what you've lost. And fortunately, there is a little known, maybe that's the same definition, but a little known U.S. Supreme Court case from 1980. Same thing. It was a private marina in Hawaii that the Corps of Engineers said, everybody, hey, come on in. Water's fine. Navigate from the ocean and go water skiing in this private marina. And the Corps declared that it was open for public use because it was navigable. And the owners objected and took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and 5-4 won a decision that said, no, if it's private under state law, has been private for a long time, that the the government cannot just declare that it's open and public property. The only way to do it properly is to take it by eminent domain and the processes and protections, including compensation that you have there. You can't just say, hey, this is used to was private property yesterday, but today it's public without doing something. So that's a fascinating case. And again, back to Oregon among us dirt lawyers is famous or infamous for a case from your Oregon Supreme Court that did that with respect to the beach rights in Cannon Beach, of all places, that for a longest time, Oregon law considered certain portions of the beach private. Well, along comes a challenger and say, we want to use this, that, or the other thing along the beach and along a riparian or properties near next to that are adjoining waterways, whether it's the ocean or the rivers. And there's this thing called this little doctrine called the public trust that we have the right to, goes back to Roman days, that people have the right to use navigable waters. But the Oregon Supreme Court said that right also includes the right to access navigable waters, even if Oregon law for the longest time said that it had to cross over what was Oregon law said was private property. Well, the court kind of did a little sleight of hand, in my opinion, and rewrote 150 years of Oregon law to declare the property public. And it never was private, notwithstanding what 150 years of Oregon law said. So you have to be a little bit careful about those type of things. Unfortunately, we can talk about these situations over and over where that happened.
Yeah.
And we're in the business of trying to take that little obscure case from Hawaii that the U.S. Supreme Court decided favorably in the property owner and remind people that it's still the law, that you can't do things like it sounds like they're doing to you at the lake.
Yeah. Yeah. I just sold my house this last year. So I did take some, I would say I took a loss a little bit on that because people are like, well, who knows how that's going to go. The Supreme Court in Oregon said, okay, well now you have, people can access the lake, even though they've made it very hard to do it. They have to kind of crawl down a seawall and to get in there. So somebody in theory could get in there with a paddleboard or something, but there's absolutely no physical way yet for them because they haven't taken everything's private around there. So there wasn't a public boat launch because it was private. So it's all private property, but the only city park that's up against it, you have to climb down a little seawall, go across some rocks, and you could get in down there. But I'm just waiting for phase two, right?
What type of boats? I mean, if there's no launch facility, they bring in kayaks and rafts?
For that, there are launch facilities, but those are part of what they call these easements that are for the owners that are. So I had the ability to join one of three easements. And so you pay for the maintenance of that easement and it'll have a boat launch. It'll have a dock. It'll have picnic spots and boats you can borrow or kayaks you can borrow and canoes and stuff like that. But you could go out skiing and stuff on it. No problem.
The public can't use those, right?
The public can't do it, but they just gave them right to put their own kayaks or something on there. So
okay. That's
the first, that's kind of the slippery slope of the first part through the Supreme Court there. But I bet you there's 10 more years of court cases in that beast.
Yep. And another one to watch is we've got a case that originated in a New Mexico non-navigable river, non-navigable stream. And the public was coming in and using that. It's not supposed to be publicly accessible because it's non-navigable. It's private property, not only the riverbed, but the access to that thing. But the state of New Mexico sort of rewrote the laws and effectively put up a sign telling the public, come on in. And because of that, not only was the owner's quiet enjoyment of the property disturbed, but of course, people come in and have a party on the stream and kind of they're not good stewards of the land. And our clients had to keep it up or even and clean it up all the time. And we're now taking that case. Unfortunately, we lost those cases in the lower courts, but we're now taking that case to Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court on that issue. But so, yeah, your situation is not unfortunately limited to you and your lake, but is one that is quite common and frequent across the country.
I'm sure every state has their own issues with that, depending on where you're located. But you guys also do a lot of what I would call either separation of powers or due process stuff too out there from, hey, I permitted this 40 years ago, but now you want me to tear it down.
Yeah. I mean, not only within, we have several sort of distinct units within Pacific, the law firm, Pacific Legal Foundation. Mine focuses on property rights. We have three other groups. One focuses on energy and environmental laws like Clean Water Act and state overregulation. Or let's say in some states, they have anti-fracking measures in place and anti-energy measures. We have another group that, as you say, focuses on maybe a more technical issue of separation of powers. And it's essentially trying to curb in excesses in our system doesn't like concentration of power in any particular branch of government. We tend not to be that trustful, I suppose, of government. And the more that power is confused and distributed, the better off we all are. We see that trend going in the other direction. And so we've got a group set up, designed to focus on those issues. And the other issue that we focus on a lot is called equality and opportunity, that somewhere in the mix, we think, the idea of equality in the law has really become inequality in the law in favor of particular people or groups or things. And we have a group set up designed to look for those type of cases as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild. I mean, and then, and again, I see stuff here where we're seeing battles here in Oregon, just because I see it in the news here and it's local. But you've got issues now that it's been going through the courts where the state says, well, you have to use a union person for this job. And those kind of things also get interesting, too, because, again, they're telling you who you can hire and who you can't due to not because of the quality of the work, but just you have to follow this because they want to support an organization.
Forcing employees who don't want to be in the union or don't want to have their union dues go to, let's say if a union endorses political candidates or makes political statements saying, hey, okay, hey, I don't want, these are mandatory union dues. So you're effectively putting words in my mouth that I don't agree with, right? I have to pay for a union that goes out and makes political statements. So you see some of that as well, right? Pretty commonly.
Yeah.
And the U.S. Supreme Court and several state courts have dealt with that issue lately. And that's handled by one of the other groups I just mentioned within our law firm does that. We don't do that within my property rights group. But my colleagues do that and others. So if you have a case like that, give them a call.
Yeah. The other one I'm seeing, too, is just building department issue stuff that's just way crazy. I mean, great example, city of Portland here. When they took all of their permits and went electronic with them, they somehow lost about 8 years of permits in that transition. So I have had multiple clients go through projects where they were told by the previous homeowner they have plans with a permit stamp on it that it was accepted, but there's no record of it. And the city goes, well, prove that you got a permit.
Yep. And they put the burden on you. Yep, that I know of at least one other situation like that invalidating something like 10,000 historical permits. And then now saying all of these owners have illegal structures that at least in the county's position go back with daily violations of, I don't know, $100. But, oh, you've been in violation by our records, the records we lost or don't have. You've been in violation for 25 years at $100 a day. And that is one thing we're raising right now. We're about to file a lawsuit against the city and county of Honolulu for the short-term rental issue. And in the city and county, it's minimum, well, it varies, but it's anywhere between minimum 30 days or 31 days or whatever it is. And I think now it's up at 180 days. You can't rent for less than 180 days. But the important thing is they also make it illegal simply to advertise your property for rent. So
sounds like Cannon Beach.
Yeah. And when I ask people to guess what the daily fine is, those people who have had dealt with building departments and planning departments before say, I don't know, $150-$200 a day. No, $10,000 a day is the violation, is the cost. And so we have a client, an 81-year-old widow, who rented her property on one of the electronic platforms. And while she was in the hospital due to a car accident, somehow her property, which she didn't rent for less than the minimally allowed legal period, got advertised, or you could click and click 2 days or something instead of 31 days.
Yep.
And city zoning inspectors went and clicked and sent her a notice of violation and said it took her 59 days once she got out of the hospital. Oh, she got out. Oh, my goodness. I better deal with this. Dealt with it. Fixed it within 2 minutes. Dealt with the platform and said, hey, get that. Don't make it so people can click 2 days only. It's 30 days here in Honolulu. They did. But meanwhile, it was 59 days at 10 grand a day. So the city's coming after her for $590,000.
Wow, that makes my $1,000 fine for using the solo stove in the driveway look small.
Yeah, or your fire pit, right?
Exactly.
We look for those type of cases as well. And again, fortunately for us, the U.S. Constitution and state constitutions bar what they call excessive fines.
Yes.
And we think 10 grand a day for a mistake, kind of, if there was a definition, an example in the dictionary of what an excessive fine is, that would qualify.
No kidding, especially when it's an administration issue of a website that she's not in control of.
Right. And it's not like she rented it or intended to rent it. Or if these guys showed up and said, I have a reservation, you have to honor it. She'd say, I can't. It's illegal. Right.
Yeah. That's a VRBO or Airbnb or whoever was administrating that. I have no idea who it was, but that's their problem. But it's now her problem because it's costing her tons of money for that.
So look for that one. Very soon
is
when we will launch that one. But yeah, I mean, again, there's not a, you wish there wasn't. Maybe in my dream is to have the world such that I'd have to go be a estate planning lawyer or something like that, because none of these problems would exist, right? That everybody, the government played by the rules, did not come after people like this. But I have to say, unfortunately, I don't think there's any danger of us being put out of business anytime soon because they keep doing it.
And it seems like it's getting worse, not better.
A lot of those of us who've been around for a while have seen a lot. What's very good now is that with the internet, with social media, with media itself, they cover these stories that would never make anything, maybe but the local paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an opportunity to find out more what's going on. And I've wondered that same thing is it that it's happening more? Is it that we know about that it's happening more?
And the perception is wild.
Yeah. I've been around doing this for 35 years or so. And so I'm so into it that, it's always been this way, but maybe it hasn't. Is it getting worse?
Yeah. And I think before, to be honest, I think what might have happened too is you have your local, let's call it your local newspaper. They maybe don't want to step on the toes of the local commissioners and, hey, let's do a little tiny story on the back of the B section or something. And yeah, you know, bury it where nowadays it's
facility, right? Yeah. Where they have the weekly menu of the senior facility or the school.
Exactly. Yeah. It's buried in there and they covered it. But really, now I think somebody posts it up on TikTok and it's out there.
Boom. Right. And we see that too with the willingness of lawyers, right? Mm-hmm. Or clients, let's say. And for the longest time before I came to this, the nonprofit that I work for now as a lawyer, that vibe was definitely there. You had clients who had multiple projects maybe underway. And you didn't want to be the guy that sues the city because they did a bad thing with respect to project A, because you got project B, C, D, and E there. But if you challenge them on A, there's at least a feeling that B, C, D, and E are going to end up in the later box or in purgatory someplace. And so there's that as well. And there is a sense that sometimes local law firms may not want to do that, which is why one of the reasons our outfit was formed is we don't have those kind of ties, right? We're not from the area, generally speaking. And so we're not bound to say we're worried about the political relationships with the local governments and appeasing them. We can look for cases that are good cases to develop and shape the law the right way, regardless of what impacts they may have.
Yeah, it makes sense. You're not trying to step on, you're not worried about stepping on Jim and Tina's making up names down at the city hall. You're not worried about stepping on their toes because you got a barbecue with them next weekend.
Precisely. Precisely.
Makes sense.
We think that's helped. I mean, in terms of making the law more predictable, more uniform, more, let's say, government actions conforming to the requirements that you read either in state laws or the U.S. Constitution or other places. The whole idea of having these laws here is to make it so you and I know how to shape our behavior in a way that's predictable and maybe we hope is least burdensome. But boy, you've got to be a lawyer just to if you want to do some remodelings on your house, not only have to be your own GC, you got to go be a lawyer too, right? At your own risk, right? You move a piece of dirt that's wrong and it turns out that it's part of wetlands. Better call me up because the U.S. attorney could be knocking on your door. And I thought I had a dirt field. And there's literally a case like that from 15 years ago at the U.S. Supreme Court. Farmer plowed what every picture I've ever seen looks like just some fields for his crops. Well, it turns out that it was deemed wetlands under government regulations. And so he got criminally charged with violation of the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. And it's everywhere. I mean, it's just like here with we pulled every permit we needed to on that Cannon Beach House remodel. And the inspection for the permit for the short-term rental permit that we had to do was 10 times the inspection of the building department and the electrical department. And it's like, wow, way deeper inspection than even what the building department was doing.
Yeah, there was a study released not too long ago about why are the median home price in California, something like $900,000. Well, $200,000 or more of that is regulatory burden, the costs of regulatory compliance. And yeah, I'm not saying, and we're not saying that we should just be the Wild West and just build whatever you want. But there's got to be some kind of limits to that because it's forcing people out. California had this massive out-migration of people moving to places that are less burdensome, have less burdensome regulatory scheme, a little more freedom. Florida's a prime example. Texas is a prime example. But, you know, when you lose your young people to other states because they can't afford to live there, unless they live in two or three generation households with their grandpa and grandma, something's off kilter. That should tell you something's off kilter. So that's what motivates us in many circumstances is we're trying to, you know, ultimately, yeah, we're interested in shaping government behavior to the requirements of law, but also to the sort of the real consequences of not doing so. And that's like, yeah, my house, I can't afford a house because it's $1.2 million in my neighborhood. If I want to live in the neighborhood I've lived in with my mom and dad all my life, when it comes time to leave the nest, I can't afford to do so.
Yeah. Well, that's crazy. I mean, like here, for instance, they just put a hold on it because everybody's been leaving Portland, same kind of thing. Yeah. But as of a year ago, if you were going to go pull a permit to build a house on an existing lot that maybe had a burned down house or something on it, you could spend $90,000 on permit fees because you had to give money to transit, to the parks, to water, and all of those little hoops to jump in to fund all these other little pet projects. But nonetheless, it still added $90,000 to the price of a house.
Yeah, they're a very famous case, and I always mistake how to pronounce this town in Oregon. Tigard,
right next door to me.
Oh, well, very, very, very famous case along Fano Creek that went to the U.S. Supreme Court on those permitting fees. And the court said, struck down the city's attempt to impose said not only did you have to give up some fees, but you guys should give up a portion of your properties for a bike path hardware store wanted to do a little renovation. And so the city said, as a condition of that, you got to give up a bike path along the creek. And the owner was like, what is what I'm doing have to do with a bike path? The city's response was, well, we can. That's why.
Yep. I forgot about that until you mentioned it. I remember that because I remember that hitting a number of years back, and That's exactly what it was. Fano Creek Trail, which goes right up the road from me. So
if you're ever on the trail,
yep.
One of the conditions when the owner finally wins and said, and the city says, okay, cry uncle, and we tap out. What do you want, owner? The owner said, well, help me pay some of my attorney's fees, and I want you to put a plaque on the bike path that said, with the case name and citation from the U.S. Supreme Court to remind people of that. It's very famous among us dirt lawyers, and we go there and take pictures of the plaque that's set into the ground right there on the bike path.
Okay, I think for this episode, I'm going to have to go find that and use that as our cover.
There you go. There you go. I can give you the GPS coordinates.
There we go. I know where it is because it's right over by the pub that's there too, that's on the trail. So it's right in that same area.
I forget what the main street is through town where it crosses the bike path.
Yep.
It used to be an Ace Hardware.
100%.
It's no longer anymore because the owners passed away. But one of the things that Mrs. Dolan said she wanted before at the end of the case was she wanted that plaque to remind people, and there it is. So it's really neat. I don't know why. It's just it's not this spectacular national park, but we kind of go there and pay homage to her anytime we're in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. Well, Robert, we're running out of time, brother. What is the best way to people to find you guys if they have a case, if they want to donate to the cause and help support you guys? How do they do that?
You're talking my language. The easiest, best place is like everything else on the web, www.pacificlegal.org, or just hit your search engines and say, find me Pacific Legal Foundation. You're going to find us. We have a place where we say, if you have questions, comments, a potential case you want us to evaluate free of charge, give us some details. Let us know how to find you. Tell us what's going on and hit send, and it'll come to us. I get those every day. We love talking to people and evaluating their cases. We may not be able to take every case that comes along, but we're very happy to take a look at it without charging legal fees. So find out what we do. There's a donation place where donations, we live 100% on donations. And our donors have very generously allowed us to go out and do things and fight the good fight. So anything. Most of our donors are small donors. They're not big corporate donors, that sort of thing. So most of our funding comes through smaller, modest, individual donations. Everything helps.
There's a big safety orange.
Yeah, the government litigates without budget, except it's your money. If you have hire private lawyers, one of the first things I used to do was to tell a lot of clients, I want to take your case as a private lawyer, but I can't because it makes no economic sense to take your case. And the government's going to sit there and string you out till you bleed out economically. We don't worry about that with PLF. If the principle is good, if the case is good, we're in, we stay the course. You don't worry about budget.
Robert, thank you for coming on the show, man. I love what you guys are doing, Pacific Legal Foundation. Robert H. Thomas, brother, thanks for coming on today and educating everybody. I love this.
Eric, it's a pleasure to have met you and to talk a little shop with you for the last hour. I appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. I'm Eric G. You've been listening to Around the House.
No one ever talks about the nights they went to bed, counting them sheet, catching seas, getting beauty rest, acting your age, don't make the good story, knock one back, no buzz, no glory. No one ever talks about the shots they didn't take, drinks they never drank, hell they never raised, yee-haw, yee-haw.